Good evening. Welcome to Oklahoma Watch Out, sponsored by Oklahoma Watch. It's great to be in Tulsa. I love this town. My name is David Fritzy, and I'm executive editor of Oklahoma Watch. Just a brief note about who we are. We are a nonprofit, nonpartisan journalism team, and we're all about doing investigative and in-depth reporting on some of the most important public policy issues in Oklahoma. Tonight, our discussion is about mental and emotional health in Oklahoma, and we have two very knowledgeable and passionate experts on the subject. Terry White, who is Commissioner of the Oklahoma Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, and Michael Brose, who is Executive Director of the Mental Health Association in Tulsa, and I believe soon to be renamed.
We are doing business as Mental Health Association Oklahoma now. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Spreading their wings. Before we jump into some questions and discussion, I'd like to give a few thank yous. One is to we want to thank for the general support of Frank Crystal of KWGS and the Oklahoma Public Media Network. And in addition, we'd like to express our appreciation to Circle Cinema, which donated this beautiful theater space for us to use this evening. This is a question and answer session. We'll start out with a few questions from me to the guests, and then we'll very quickly open it up. We have two people with handheld microphones. Warren Veith, our associate editor, has one. Evie Holzer, who helps us with event organization, also has one for the other side of the aisle. And we invite you, please, to ask your questions, and we'll try to get as many of those in as we can during the hour we have. My first question is for Commissioner White. Oklahoma is known as a very friendly place, but when you look at all the statistics, it seems like there are also a lot of very unhappy people. So the mental health, where we stand in mental health, it just seems to be a continuing issue. Why does Oklahoma have this problem, and what is being done to address it?
Well, first, let me say thank you for having me here this evening, and thank you all for coming out for this discussion. I think there are several things that lead into this. One of the biggest thing is this is a huge topic right now, mental health and substance abuse, sometimes for not very good reasons. Some really tragic things have happened around the United States. We actually have tragedies here in Oklahoma every single day, but they're things like suicide, and so it doesn't get reported in the same way. We have these tragedies that are happening, and it gives us an opportunity to turn that tragedy into a discussion, because if we look at mental health simply as the tragedies, we've completely missed the boat, because people can and do recover every single day, and I'm going to talk about that in just a little bit. But I think what the real issue is that we are an incredibly unhealthy state. When you look at our health rankings, we're usually ranked 48th, 49th, 50th. A couple years ago, if you remember, we were 43rd, and we were really excited, right, that we had moved to 43rd, which, don't get me wrong, that's the right direction, but we're really unhealthy. We have high rates of all kinds of diseases. And so what's not surprising is that we have high rates of mental illness and addiction, because mental illness and addiction are diseases just like any other disease, and I think that may be one of the most important things that we have got to grasp as a state. And I think it's a pretty important reason why these sort of pictures are up. It truly shows you the science that these are diseases of the brain, just like where diabetes is a disease of the pancreas, where the pancreas isn't secreting the right amount of insulin. Mental illness and addiction are diseases of the brain where the chemicals aren't working correctly. Either in the case of mental illness, they're not being secreted correctly, or taken up and used correctly, or in the case of addiction, because of the chemicals that have been added to the body, once they hit the bloodstream and then the brain, different chemical reactions happen in the brain than otherwise would have been there. But people can and do recover, and recovery also happens in the brain. So when we think about being an unhealthy state, what would be really weird is if we had really low rates of mental illness and addiction. We had high rates of heart disease, high rates of cancer, high rates of diabetes, and then we had these bizarrely healthy brains trapped in these really unhealthy bodies. That would be what would be strange. But because we have high rates of all these diseases, of course we also have unhealthy brains and high rates of mental illness and addiction. And the last thing I'll say, because I could talk for like 3 hours about this, probably like 24 hours, but probably no one cares this much about that as me and would want to listen to me for 24 hours. But what would be really, when we look at the mental illness, the third leading cause of chronic disease in our state, the third leading cause of chronic disease is mental illness. Only pulmonary conditions and hypertension are more common, which makes mental illness as a chronic disease that affects Oklahomans more common than cancer, more common than stroke, more common than diabetes, more common than heart disease. And I don't think most Oklahomans get that and understand how critical this is to our overall health and then ultimately to our overall outcomes, because it affects every single thing in our state. If we want high rates of graduation, if we want high rates of employment, if we want high rates of healthy families, if we want high rates of people engaged in their community, if we want low rates of people involved in the criminal justice system, in the back of police cars, in jail cells, in prison cells, if we want fewer people in child welfare, every single one of those, if you look at the common thread, one is poverty, the other is mental illness and addiction, and it's going untreated, mental illness and addiction going untreated.
You know, there is one promise in the air, and that is we may have more access to mental health coverage. So I'd like to ask Director Broz, we have the Affordable Care Act, we have the new federal rules on parity that would, again, increase access. Do you think all of this will move the needle on mental health in Oklahoma and in the area you serve?
Well, yes, the short answer. The long answer is that we have got to, as a state, we've got to embrace this. And I have to tell the audience here is that things are, I'd call them discombobulated right now in terms of the Affordable Care Act. And so, but at the same time, I think all of us need to be incredibly patient with the process. Big turns, moving that needle, it gets messy, it's complicated, what have you. But if you, you know, I attended a breakout in Washington, D.C. Last June. And in this breakout, I listened to people talk from the state of Maryland. Now, Maryland is a state that has embraced the Affordable Care Act. And I heard these people talking about it, and it was really amazing how much they were talking about prevention. Now, when we talk about what Terry's talking about in terms of in the previous question, you know how unhealthy we are mentally, well, one of the ways we've got to do that, we've got to move upstream. We treat things downstream in Oklahoma. We've got to move upstream and be more preventative and trying to identify things earlier, early childhood, be able to give access to care, what have you. And I think if we can really embrace this, I think we can move that needle. We're moving the needle now with the limited resources that we're putting in place. We're doing that by we're thinking smarter, we're working more collaboratively, we're being innovative, we're doing some of the most innovative things in the country right here in Oklahoma. And there's a bunch of people in this room, different agencies, different people who are a part of that and what you're doing. So we are going to be able to move that needle. But we've got to continue to work together, and we've got to be able to cover it, and we've got to be able to make sure that we've got to pay for it anyway, right? Does everybody get that? You've got to pay for it anyway. Let's pay for it through an insurance program and not pay for it in other ways that are a lot of times wrapped up in tragedies and way downstream, and people get hurt. Lives are destroyed. People aren't able to fulfill their lives in the fullest, most robust way in the quality of life that all of us here in Oklahoma want for ourselves and our children.
Okay, let's say I have new coverage for mental health through the Affordable Care Act, the exchange, private employer. What about providers? Are there enough psychologists, psychiatrists, providers? Commissioner White, I mean, what's your sense?
So that's why I think this is a really one of the things I want to make sure we all understand is there's not just one magic silver bullet. It's not just that, because while we do have capacity in our provider systems, we have several amazing partners in this room who could serve more people tomorrow. If there were resources, at some point we also know that we have a shortage in certain areas. There's less than 20 practicing child psychiatrists in the entire state of Oklahoma. Can you imagine what it's like to be a parent, desperate, and some of you I know can, desperately searching for services for your child, particularly if you live in rural Oklahoma, because sometimes there's just not a practitioner within hundreds of miles. Now, we've done some innovative things, like Mike said, that we have the largest Department of Mental Health and Substance Services and our partners have the largest public telemedicine system in the United States for public behavioral health. It is incredible. We have won national awards, and we are getting services to the rural areas, but we still have a huge gap between how many people need services and how many people get it. And so, yes, there is provider capacity now, but there are also areas like nursing and other areas where we know there's still shortages, people looking desperately to hire licensed clinicians that can't find them. And one of the other things that we really struggle with that we also have to talk about is there are people today who have lots of resources, and they still can't get the help they need or the right fit. And so, or they have family members who aren't willing to get help, or they're not willing to talk about it because of the stigma. So this is a multifaceted issue. It's not just one silver bullet.
You know, one of the most telltale signs of mental illness is suicide rates, and we have a very high suicide rate. It seems like we have a high rate for so many categories. And I know that there are efforts at the state and with the Mental Health Association to try and address this. So if you could fill us in briefly, Michael, on what's going on with you, and then also at the state level, Terry.
Absolutely.
Well, again, some of you in this room have heard me speak about this many times. Some of you haven't. But again, the question that I always love to ask audiences is, how many suicides on average do we have in this country? Well, we have 30,000 plus suicides in this country every year. And how many homicides on average do we have in this country every year? About 18,000. We have it's been that way for years, twice as many suicides in this country as we have homicides. And that is a shocking number to many, many people. So we don't publicize it well. We don't really, we've got to figure out some ways how to communicate that more out to our constituencies. David, you and I talked about some of those ideas. Maybe if we can't tell the stories, maybe we need to have a clicker on our corner of our websites that shows every time there's a homicide, we change the number every time there's a homicide, so people could literally see that in reality. So we've got to be able to prevent that, and we've got to be able to do that. And, you know, one of the things that, like, we all the kind of innovative, like, question, persuade, refer. Ask a question, save a life. I wish I had a nickel for everybody that's told me, man, I wish I would have known what to ask my friend, my family member, what have you. There will never be enough providers. There will never be. I don't care what we do, but we can all be trained in this room in the same way. I would imagine probably 80% of the people in this room have been through a CPR course at least once in your lifetime. And you can go through 1 hour and you can be trained in question, persuade, and refer, and learn the basic skills of how you interact with someone in your family, a friend, a coworker, on what to say to them and how to potentially ask that question and save their life to help them get the resources and get to the place that they need to be. And so we really can do that and see that rate come down. Terry talked about those low health care rates in Oklahoma. Well, guess where we're at in the suicide rate? Way up at the top. We're losing our people. We had 10 adolescent suicides last year in a 12-month period in around Metro Tulsa. 10. We've lost 10 of our teenagers to suicide. That is 10 too many. And we've got a lot of work to do. We're losing people because and to self-harm.
Yeah. What's at the state level?
Yeah, so we're actually 13th in the nation. We are 13th in the nation. That is not a good thing. And we're going the wrong way. In the most recent year of data, which is 2010, it shows that we had 610 suicides in Oklahoma. And let me build on something Mike is saying and maybe be even just a little bit more direct. Suicide is a preventable cause of death, and that's one of the biggest myths that surrounds this. People feel uncomfortable talking about it. Sometimes when I'm in rooms, not so much here because so many of you know this, because of the amazing work Mental Health Association of Tulsa has done, for example, with Tulsa Police Department to lower the suicide rates in Tulsa. But people get uncomfortable talking about suicide, and they believe all this mythology that if it's inevitable, if someone wants to do it, they're going to accomplish it. Or we shouldn't talk about it because it might plant the idea in someone's mind.
Right.
The idea is already there if they're thinking about it,
right.
And it's a preventable cause of death. And the single best thing you can do is what Mike just talked about: QPR, question, persuade, refer. But let me be very clear what we mean by question. Ask the question very directly: are you thinking of killing yourself? And I'm going to say it again, because if you've ever seen me speak, I say it several times because it makes people so uncomfortable. You have to be able to say, are you thinking of killing yourself? Are you thinking of killing yourself? are you thinking of killing yourself? Because until you can ask someone that directly, you may miss the chance to save their life. But the research shows over and over, asking that question for someone who is contemplating suicide most likely will save their life because they're waiting for someone to ask. So ask that question, and then if nothing else, help them call the suicide hotline. 211. Call 211 in Tulsa. I can give you the whole 1-800 number, but 211. Call the suicide hotline with them, and you can save a life. And we can all do that the same way we can all do CPR.
I'm just curious. I know there are many from the mental health community in the audience, but has anyone been through the QPR training?
Great. Do we have any trainers in the room? Mm-hmm. There's a trainer right there. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I'd like to open up to the audience a chance to ask any questions. Mental health is a broad topic, but you feel free to ask any question you wish. We have microphones again with Warren over here and Evie, if anyone has a question for either of our guests.
I'm one of those people with resources who couldn't get help for my kids. Mm-hmm. I adopted 3 kids out of foster care 3 years ago, 2 of whom have been institutionalized. Mr. Bros has assisted us, and I want to thank both of you for what you've done in Oklahoma. So here's the thing. Legislators, listen to me because I can walk the walk. Mm-hmm. What 3 things do I say to legislators? Everything is so big and so overwhelming. What 3 things do I ask for when I actually get their ear? Thank you.
So I will just tell you one. Mike may have others to add, and nobody likes my answer on this. And I'm just going to tell you right now, nobody likes it. But it is the truth. Fund it. Fund mental health and substance abuse services. And I have to say, Governor Fallon has made this a priority since she came into office, and she has fought for funding every year and been successful. But I will tell you, and as much support as she has gotten from the legislature, they have to make up for decades of underfunding. And so I know that this is hard, and I know people want me to say, well, if we change this law here and we change this law here, or we did this or we did that, and there are some law changes that could be helpful, so I don't want to downplay those, but the single biggest issue is we don't have enough services. People are driving, law enforcement's driving all over the state, hundreds of miles trying to find beds for people. We have outpatient waiting lists that have criteria, and we turn people away every day because, gosh, you're just not sick enough. Right? Because we only can serve the most ill. So come back when you're sicker, because that's a really great way to do healthcare, right? If you had heart disease and we said, well, your heart's 20% damaged, come back when it's 50% and then you'll be sick enough, right? We wouldn't do that. And it really does come down to and many other nuances, but I'm just going to give you one, and it's resources. They've got to fund it. They have to fund it. They have to fund it.
I'm going to give you another word to go with funding. And I was going to say money, funding. Organize. We need to organize better. Mm-hmm. We're not well organized. We're getting beat politically. We've got to organize more effectively. And I want you to know, by the way, we are still working in the final pieces of a support group for families. Remember we talked about that? And we talked about then out of the outgrowth of that would be that then maybe some of the family members could organize themselves. Because sometimes – you know, Terry and her staff doing an amazing job with the legislature. But sometimes we get to be talking heads. But people that are affected, that are impacted directly, you guys are much, much more effective than we are. Or we join forces in an organized way to be more effective. And, you know, I don't know. One of these days you may get a tweet from me that I'm walking from here to the legislature. I don't know. We've got to do a better job of organizing and doing a better job. So
I would totally do that with you, actually.
You'd do that with me?
I totally would.
I believe there was a question up there. Yes.
Can I go first?
I'll go first. Okay. I've heard this story so many times. One of the stories that I came with is I got a call a couple weeks ago from a retired employee of one of our nonprofits who their former coworkers, some of them are present in this room right here, and called me up because she knew me, telling me about her 26-year-old son, very symptomatic, the phenomena that someone whose brain is ill doesn't recognize it's ill. Everybody else, it's obvious to everybody else. What do you do? And you know, where does it land? And at what point can you intervene? And you know what I think what we're really missing is we really don't have in this country and in this state a really designated, agreed upon, researched, protocol that gives us some directions, that has a legal basis, it has a law enforcement basis, it has a mental health intervention basis, where all of that's collaborated and very thought through very carefully, where we have a protocol that's been agreed upon, and that we're going to try to divert people out of jail if it comes to that, and make sure that they're in treatment, what have you, and that we're going to be very supportive to those families while they're in this crisis that you're talking about. And I mean, I've been hearing about it and hearing about it since the day I took this job, and it breaks my heart. I work closely. There's people in this room have called me. I've worked with them, worked with their families, communicated, and I'm going to do that till they drag me out of here. But we've got a lot of work to do in that area, and we've got to figure that out. I don't accept that answer that you've been told. There are things that we can do. And you call me, and I'll do everything. I'll put the power of my organization behind you any way I can to be available to you and your family. And my friends here from NAMI will be right there with me.
And so let me just say to that, one, I hear your frustration, and I think that it's really important that we...
No.
I think we have to acknowledge that.
You're every right to your frustration. No,
yeah,
you're
fine.
I think
we have to acknowledge that. And I think that, I'm going to give you some things that I think aren't specific to your situation. I think calling Mike is probably going to be one of the best things that you can do. So let me just say that right up front. But part of it is identifying these diseases earlier. Because what happens is we get to the point where people are so ill and they're over 18, and there is some legal issues about forcing people into treatment that we do have to be aware of. So it is a difficult walk for families, more so than probably anybody else other than the person suffering, although they may not realize how difficult it is on them right then. But identifying things earlier and getting people engaged in treatment earlier would make a huge, huge difference. A huge difference. But there are folks who have been in your exact situation, and they have had a loved one who just doesn't believe they need help, and somehow, and I'm not saying it happens every single time, but somehow they finally make the connection work somehow. And I think that's where your local folks are going to be able to help you specifically in your area, we hope, because let's be honest, mental illness and addiction sometimes are some of the most heartbreaking diseases because of this exact issue Mike was describing. If I don't have a disease of the brain, I can understand that I have heart disease, or I can see that I have a broken arm. But sometimes when it's the organ that thinks, the brain, that is also diseased, it makes it infinitely more complicated than any other disease.
And if we do get them into treatment, we don't want them in the back of police cars dragged across the state. And I really applaud Terry and her team to help us fund and have more beds that we've increased. We're still short, but we've made some real progress, so we begin to reduce that, and we're trying to measure that now in terms of the reduction of the number of people. But to transport people, again, if we're going to transport, let's do appropriate medical transport. Let's not do back of police cars, you know, or let's start putting everybody who needs to be transferred to a hospital somewhere else, let's put them in the back of a police car too for heart disease or whatever. We think about that, we would think, well, that's really ludicrous. But somehow, with someone who is sick and their mind is sick, their brain is ill, is that somehow okay to do it that way? Really? I don't think so. I think we've got to really rethink that. And sometimes we just need to, you know, the cultural sort of phenomena that we sort of all live in a trance sometime, that we just do it that way. Why did we do it that way? Because we've always done it that way. Sometimes we need to wake up and sort of step back from that and really rethink about how we go about things and the protocols that we use, and step back from that. And we need family member and consumer participant in that process, because you guys, they need a voice and they need to be at the table with us. I'm sorry, yeah. I know Terry's trying to get. I just want to make this point, is that really, with the science that Terry referenced in these pictures, if you stop and think about it in terms of our culture in this country, that we're, by my estimation, we're about 100 years behind the thinking. If you read Clifford Beer's book, A Mind That Found Itself, and you read the attitudes that were going on then, and they knew very little about mental illness, really? We're still basically carrying around those attitudes and those prejudices in our mind. But yet the science has prescribed it. Look at the pictures of these brains. But we're still not treating it and thinking about it as we do heart disease, about a disease of the liver, cancer, whatever. We've got to move that needle a long ways.
And part of that, I think is really important, what Mike's saying, is calling on the other parts of the healthcare industry. Because let me just say, The Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services is never going to solve this by ourselves. We are never going to have enough resources. Although funding is what we have to fight for, we're still never going to have enough. And so when we talked earlier about mental illness being the third leading cause of chronic disease, more common than heart disease, more common than cancer, more common than stroke, more common than diabetes. Think about what the facilities look like where you go for treatment for heart disease, cancer, stroke, or diabetes. The beautiful new diabetes center that was completed in Oklahoma City and the beautiful new cancer center. The cancer center of Tulsa that's kind of close out there on the highway. And it's beautiful, right? And it's a place that you go and you think, I'm going to get medical care and I'm going to get better and it's welcoming. And then think about the mental health and substance use facilities. We're really fortunate because Tulsa is a little bit unique. You have a philanthropic community that is amazingly supportive of mental illness and addiction that most communities in Oklahoma just don't have. They don't have anything like it. So you do have some beautiful mental health and substance use facilities. But some of the facilities, because not everybody can solve everything, they don't look very hopeful. And if you look at most of the state, sometimes they're in the abandoned strip malls, you know, where nobody else is because that's where they can afford the rent. And do you think people go there and think, gosh, this is a place of medical care and recovery, even though that's exactly what's happening inside those walls? It's treatment from a brain disease. It doesn't look like it from the outside. And we have to fix some of that, too. And we need all of our partners to step up. I'm just going to put on the table, we need the private sector in Tulsa to step up as well. The business community, as well as the healthcare providers, because there is a huge shortage in Tulsa of psychiatric beds, and the majority of the beds are provided by the state. And we're glad we can be the provider, but we can't do it by ourselves. So we need other people stepping up too, and they need to be places that look hopeful and look like medical care, and this all becomes a one part of healthcare, the same way the brain is part of our body.
One quick question before we go to the next question. Any chance of more funding this coming session? The budgets are tight.
I will be perfectly honest. I've had this conversation recently. I am very, very worried because what the message we keep getting is flat budget, flat budget, flat budget. What that means is same dollars you got last year. And we have a situation because of certain things we're required to do. Grant match for systems of care, an amazing program serving the most complex kids with mental health and substance abuse services. Our grant match is required next year. We hold the dollars for Medicaid. And without going into a lot of detail, there's about $13 million we have to have just to maintain this Medicaid program next year in our budget. When it's all said and done, if we don't have $20 million additional dollars next year, and we're being told flat budget for everybody, or be prepared that that's the potential cause. We know that there are folks who want to fight for more and figure out how to do that. But if we don't get an additional 20, we're looking at cutting the system that exists right now, not increasing it. So I am very concerned. And so I know this is hard for people, and I know legislators see me coming, and they're like, she's coming for money. And they say, they've said, she's relentless. It's never enough. And I keep saying, I am grateful. I am so grateful for the leadership the governor has had on this, and I'm so grateful for the leadership of the House and the Senate and that they've funded this the last several years. But I'm the one who's looking at the families and the forums like this. I'm the one who's taking the calls from parents who can't find help, and I know that there's still so many people hurting who can't get help that are desperately trying that we have to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. We really lost that whole concept of investing in our people, and that's what we're talking about. It's about an investment. It's an investment in our future, the investment of our health and the future of our state. And we've really kind of lost that whole concept. It's always about, flat, no taxes, you know, reduced taxes, what have you. The common good, the common investment in the people of this country, that's what we're talking about. And we've sort of kind of lost that as a culture. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the science and the technology that we're talking about, the treatment of these brain disease, it exists, but it has to be paid for.
I think you had the microphone.
Thank you for being here tonight. I am a guidance counselor in a high school in a nearby rural district, and I deal with a lot of young people who experience intermittent mental health crisis. And many times I am unable to obtain the written permission from parents or guardians to have their child or student seek help, which I must have in order for them to even visit one time with a counselor. And we do have agencies that work with our district who are eager to work with these young people. And many times the young people are unabashed. They are not afraid to come to my office. They are usually in a situation they are wanting to talk to somebody. but I cannot get them to connect with somebody because I have to do a referral. A parent will not follow through. And has there ever been a dialogue about a mental health act for minors, a rights act for minors? Because I know many students would seek help on their own, and I just can't get that connection made because of a parent. And just add a little quick add-on. Many times those parents have mental health issues themselves and fear what their children might reveal to a counselor.
Yep.
So a mental health rights act for minors, has that ever been a topic of discussion? Thank you.
So there hasn't been, well, let me just say that I've been part of, that doesn't mean it hasn't happened there, I haven't been part of a discussion about a specific act of mental health services for minors. What I can tell you is we've had law changes over the last decade around minors that if someone's 16 or older, they can consent for treatment. So there has been that, but for, and I'm not a lawyer, but for lots of legal reasons, 16 was sort of where we landed. I think that that may be a very important discussion to have. I think it may also be a tough discussion in Oklahoma, given some of our values or perceived values about family rights and those things. But one of the things I think we could very easily talk about is some of that, not all of it, but some of that is also not understanding and it's stigma. And so one of the things that we could talk about is how could we provide resources or how could our partners provide resources to do an education forum for parents, for all parents, however we could reach them in your school or in any school, where we do some basic training around whether we do mental health first aid, whether we do whatever it might be, that provides some very factual information. And part of the whole point of those trainings not only is to help people get help, but it's to destigmatize this issue and to help people feel more comfortable. And so that may be, it's not an immediate solution. And I know that when you've got a kid sitting in front of you that you know needs help and you can't get a parent to consent, it doesn't help you to go, well, let's do some training and hope we can change the parent's mind. But it is some place that we could start and start to break through. And Mike,
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it doesn't help you in that situation you're right now. I mean, you know, there's some things that we could, you can always call us. We're happy to consult with you, give you ideas, what have you. We do the teen screen. We run into the same thing. If you talk to any provider in any school, whether it's not just rural, but also urban, they run into the same thing, what have you. But I think, you know, also, much like Terry said, to move upstream would be to have some sort of forum, use your parent-teacher association group to have a discussion when it's not around an event or a crisis, so you can do some education about that. Let them know that, if you asked a group of parents in a non-critical situation, like, if we determine that your child might be having some sort of a mental health crisis, how many of you would like us to give you a call and let you know and assist you get help? I bet there are a lot of hands go up. But when it's in the event itself, then fear, terror, you know, it all comes to the surface. So you're trying to do education. Again, it won't help you in that situation you're in. But those are the kind of things that we have to do to move things upstream again. So it's more in that preventative deal. And it takes time. It takes time, energy. And we are a resource for you to help you figure out how to present that if you'd like us to ever do that.
Thank you. Another question over here.
Yeah, thank you for coming to Tulsa, Commissioner. I appreciate you and Michael Bros. I had a question. You know, back in the day, they used to have alcohol treatment centers, mm-hmm. just alcohol. Mm-hmm. Then they used to have drug treatment centers, and they were really separate. Mm-hmm. But then they, over time, obviously, that was not a good idea, and they integrated. And then even further integrated when they did dual diagnosis to co-occurring. Mm-hmm. And my question is, why does the Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, when you go to work for one of those treatment agencies, why do you have to have a separate certification for CADC, LADC, when if you're LCSW or LPC or what have you, you're already well-versed in addictions counseling, but yet why? I'm just curious to that. It seems like it's still like as things have gotten together, the Department of Mental Health still has that separate.
So there are several pieces to that answer, one of which is it's not the department. We don't hold any of the licensure boards. Those are separate standalone boards. So, for example, the social workers have their own board. The LPCs, the LMFTs, the LBPs, they all have their own board. The LADCs have their own board that are separate. They're actually their own state agency. So I don't have any authority, if you will, over that. And historically over time, you know, what has happened was there was the movement among, and I don't go back far enough to tell you the whole story, but there was the movement where drug and alcohol counselors weren't sure that mental health counselors really did have the training they need. And I would argue in some cases they probably didn't. The same way I would argue that I don't think physicians get trained enough in mental health and certainly not in substance abuse.
Right.
So I do think there's some specialized training. But one of the things that is happening that I think is really amazing is there's a group that's come together the last couple of years representing the licensure boards that we are part of as the department that has talked about doing cross-training. And so now you have an LADC MH license. You have the social work license, which includes substance abuse. You also have the LPC license that has very specific requirements for substance abuse if you want to do substance abuse counseling. And maybe one day they will all integrate and it'll be one license. But just saying to people, go do that when they feel a pride in their particular license isn't really the right way to approach it, but letting them work together. So we are making progress in that. I do think we've come further than we've ever come before, but there's still a ways to go, even in our field.
I think also as we integrate, in my career, we used to completely separate that. I used to hear professionals argue, well, you got to get clean and sober before we can treat your mental illness.
Right.
Oh, we got to get your symptoms under control before we can treat your
right. –
now we have integrated that. So if you think about it, as we integrate that treatment together, is that on a good multidisciplinary team, you may have a CADC, you may have a social worker, you may have a nurse, a psychiatrist, and so not everybody brings the same thing, but if you put it all together, then you've got some real strength together to work in a very collegial and really take advantage of everybody's strengths that they have.
There's a question over here.
I'm often asked about treatment centers in the state, and I've looked at websites. Do either of you, I've not been able to find like a state registry of private and public alcohol and drug treatment centers in the state. Are you aware of one?
You guys publish one.
Yeah, so we do publish one for everybody that we have some sort of relationship with, meaning that is either certified by us or contracted by us. But there is a group that doesn't catch because there are people in private practice who don't do business with the state and aren't required to be certified by the state. And so it doesn't – one of the things that we have struggled with is how to get that list because we don't have any ability to know. And so we are continuing to have dialogues about that because one of the things that's also really – I mean – you know, kind of what we were saying earlier, we have to look at ourselves at the same time we're telling the rest of Oklahoma, hey, you need to get this issue. We also need to look at ourselves. It's really hard for someone to try to navigate the mental health and substance abuse system. When you're a family member and or a person who needs treatment, you're like, gosh, I need help. It is really challenging. And so we have to continue to make the commitment to try to make that easier and easier. But no, that is still an area where even though we get better all the time at it, we still don't have it.
Yeah, it's a big need for a family member to be able to just pull up a website
right.
and see what's available regionally, actually.
Yeah, and even beyond that, I find over and over people, they're in a crisis. They've got a loved one or family member in need. They really, all of a sudden, we struggle, we're not that user-friendly.
Right.
We got a lot of work to do. But we really, at the Mental Health Association Oklahoma, we really, really want to make ourselves available. We really try is to hold, work with, help that family assess what's going on and help them connect up with, you know, where they need to go. And we help them look at their payer source. We help them look all through that and go that. One of my students sitting over there, have we spent a lot of time on that? A lot of time on that, helping that, because that's a big thing. And we also allow that family to call back as many times as they need to until they get that help that they need. That's a big thing that we as an organization want to provide to people who need that help, because we understand how hard it is.
Let's get back to the gentleman who had the...
I apologize. I was saying that we spent quite a bit of money in the state on corrections, on law enforcement, on various different services. Has anyone ever examined the impact for the failure to treat
Absolutely.
As opposed to exactly what it costs to fund in 1 year?
Absolutely. One of the things, I'm really glad you asked that question, one of the major initiatives that the department has put together with a collaboration of partners is something called Smart on Crime that says there is a much better way to do this than waiting and dealing with the consequences to incarcerate someone, particularly for a nonviolent offense because of their mental illness and addiction. And what we did with this initiative that so far the governor has actually been able to put a little bit about a little over $10 million into. But it's a big initiative. It needs about $100 million. But that's still a huge first step. Is we looked at evidence-based programs at all levels, early intervention and diversion from first contact with law enforcement to jail diversion programs to programs like drug courts and mental health courts. And every single one of the items that we're suggesting have an evidence base behind it, is happening somewhere in Oklahoma, although it may be a tiny pocket, and shows the cost analysis of how much it costs for the program versus how much incarceration costs. The one that's the easiest for people to understand is drug court. Drug court is $5,000 a year per offender. Prison is approximately $19,000 a year per offender. Okay, so it's clearly less expensive. It's clearly less expensive, but the thing about drug court is it's by far more effective. 5 years after graduation for people in drug court, less than 25% of them have been rearrested. For people who serve their prison sentence for the same crimes 5 years after release, over 50% of them have been rearrested. So it's by far more effective and by far less expensive. Part of it is changing the mindset that was created around the nation, but particularly in Midwest and in Oklahoma, of this tough on crime, lock them up, this whole thing that happened in the 90s that has really made it challenging for people to understand their alternatives that are more effective and less expensive. But your question is exactly at the heart, I think, of one of the issues in Oklahoma where people end up in the back of a police car, in a jail cell, or in a prison cell instead of ever getting inside of a medical facility for their brain disease.
I'm going to add another angle on this, and Terry said it beautifully. But I think also we need to really look at, guess what? We're locking these people up. There are new institutions, by the way. Everybody knows that. We're all celebrating the closing of state hospitals, and now we have them in jails, what have you. Mm-hmm. But we need to start talking about and move from just the word release to discharge planning. Really thorough. These people are going to be they're going to be released. And while they are getting some treatment while they're incarcerated,
they're getting some,
but they're being released with many times nothing, no place to live, and they're not connected up to services. We need to start talking about discharge planning and not just release. And people need to be connected up, and it needs to be very thoughtfully done. Some of that's been done. We need to do a lot more in that area.
10 high school kids a year committing suicide, that really grabs a hold of me. Preventative, that's quite a word, alias prophylactic. Let's get the disease before it gets to us. What about nutrition? Let me identify myself. I'm 71 years old. I'm 5'11", 170 pounds, and I'm going on 111. I take nutritive supplements. I take 12 per meal, two main meals a day. I'm 4, 5, and 6 times a month at Aiken's Health Food Store. I'm pumping them for what's the best dosage for vitamin D3? What's this and that? You know, I'm reading these books. Okay, nutrition has such an effect on our mental condition and all that. And you can't live on what you get at the supermarket. I mean, you've got to get those nutritive supplements. And that's what I have to say.
So I'm going to answer. I'm going to take part of your question. I'm going to broaden it a little because kind of what I was going back to earlier, there's not one single silver magic bullet. But overall, health and wellness is something we're really beginning to understand is incredibly important as it relates to mental health and substance abuse. Our whole body is connected. So physical health, sleeping, nutrition, all of those things, wellness, not using tobacco. All of these things play a role in our overall health, including our brain health. So what you're bringing up is a piece of the whole puzzle, and it's about overall wellness. So the same way we're looking at the rest of the healthcare world and saying, hey, you guys, and I haven't gone on my soapbox about this part yet, but hey, you guys need to be identifying mental health and substance abuse earlier. Pediatricians, you need to be screening for it. You need to be talking to parents, general practitioners, family physicians, gynecologists, all of you guys. ERs, you need to be screening for it. Then we also have to look at ourselves and say, hey, we're the mental health and substance abuse system, and we need to be talking about overall wellness with the people that we're serving. We need to talk to them about sleeping, about exercise, about nutrition, about poor other health habits, such as tobacco and other things. So what you're bringing up is definitely a piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm.
45% of all the cigarettes sold in the United States are sold to people with serious mental illness. 45%.
I have a question about a big problem in Oklahoma, and that is prescription drug abuse. Mm-hmm. Are there any laws that need to be changed? Anything else that needs to happen to hold people accountable, doctors?
Yes. Yes.
That we need to put
yes.
in place.
Yes. In fact, last year there were four pieces of legislation that were passed around prescription drug abuse, most of which went into effect November 1st. So this is all very new. The governor led the charge on three of those bills and was very supportive of the fourth bill, limiting the refills on hydrocodone, making naloxone available. We could do 2 hours on just prescription drug abuse, making naloxone available to emergency responders and family members to save lives for people who are overdosing on prescription drugs. Providing reports to physicians out of what's called the PMP system, where the drugs that are prescribed and picked up are there. One of the major things that we need to, or one of the things the governor has been very clear she's planning to talk about this year, is mandatory use of by physicians, and let me just say, physicians aren't necessarily excited about this, although some are incredibly supportive. They have to check the PMP system before they prescribe. They would have to check the PMP system. Now, again, no silver bullet. Saying that doesn't mean this is the physician's fault, because most of prescription drugs are diversion from people's medicine cabinet that have leftover medicine that didn't dispose of it. But there was a script written in the first place for potentially more pills than were necessary, so prescribing guidelines are really important. Drug disposal, responsible disposal by family members so that your child doesn't get a hold of it, so that your neighbor doesn't get a hold of it. So when you have an open house, at open houses, prescription drugs are stolen on a regular basis. Like, this is a huge issue. So yes, there are some statutory changes that I think would be really important, and we are working with the governor's office on those right now, one of which is mandatory PMP use, but the other is getting education out there about this. There is a whole – prescription drugs is accessible to a whole group that otherwise wouldn't use it. What I mean by that is I tell people all the time, I grew up in Edmond, okay? When I was growing up, I didn't have a lot of my friends' moms that were on crack cocaine, right? There wasn't a real mom crack cocaine problem in Edmond. But I had two of my friends' moms who used Valium every day. And I knew what it meant then, but I didn't really get it like I get it now, obviously. And so prescription drugs are used by people because, one, they're accessible. They're sitting in their medicine cabinet. Most people don't have heroin in their medicine cabinet, right? But a lot of people have prescription drugs. But also people who would never try illegal drugs will try prescription drugs. But here's what happens. As people get hooked on prescription drugs and then can't afford them, or people realize what's happening, or there's doctor shopping and doctors are being responsible and not prescribing, then all of a sudden the only way to get the opioid you're now addicted to is things like heroin. So we have this huge issue around this that we have to talk about, and yes, there are things, and we will continue to publicize what we're going to be working with the governor's office on around prescription drugs this year.
I get questions all the time related to our housing. Most of you know that we operate housing for people who have histories of mental illness, histories of substance abuse, histories of homelessness. My housing manager sitting right over there, he'll tell you our problems aren't predominantly – people say, do you guys have people with drug problems, what have you? Our number one problem is prescribed medications. That's where our problems are with our individuals. And a doctor wrote me this prescription. How many of you have ever had your physician write you a prescription for a pain med and ask you before they hand you that script if you've had a history of substance abuse or addiction? How many have you ever – how long does it take to ask that question? I love my endodontist. He's been wonderful to me, and he writes me, never says a word, what have you. I never get it filled. He never asks me. He just hands it to me. I love him to death. But that's not just him isolated. That's just standard. That's how it rolls. We got to do some more education. I think we need to do some more physician, nurse, medical care education around those. Those are very powerful medications, and many of them are highly addictive.
We've talked about the need for more funding through public resources. What's happening or what's going to happen with the Affordable Care Act as far as private funding of mental health? Is that going to improve? Is there going to be more resources? I, for one, am one that has an individual plan, and I have to pay a lot of money to get mental health added on to it. Is that going to change?
Yeah, I mean, I think it will in time. I think things are going to have to shake out. They're going to have to look at that and study that, what have you. Again, if you've noticed, you know, I, among others, Monty Moeller's somewhere in the house sitting back there. I saw him. Monty and I, for years and years and years, lobbied in Washington, D.C. at our nation's capital to get mental health parity. And did you see it was passed in 2008? And I could get on that subject. But Just the other day, finally the rules came out about what that's going to look like, what have you. And so it's going to take time for that embed into private plans so we do have mental health parity. Again, not having parity for mental health care coverage, that flies in the face of everything we're talking about and everything that we believe. That's a message that somehow that doesn't matter, it's not a big deal, what have you. So I think as that begins to, as Affordable Care Act issues shake out, and I'm like knocking on wood, it's going to take some time. As it does shake out, as those mental health parity rules begin to be propagated and move into place, I think for people who, private providers for coverages, what have you, and then the marketplace will begin to work. Do we believe that? I do. Is that the marketplace will begin to work, and I think we are going to see that improve. It's going to take some time, though. It's going to take a lot of time, actually.
The Affordable Care Act, aside for a second, one of the things I want to say that you all can do to make a difference, and truly nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act, what we have to do is engage the business community about how mental health and substance abuse issues affect their workforce. Chesapeake has done an amazing job around mental health and substance abuse, and they are a self-funded entity that makes sure that they have incredible mental health and substance abuse benefits as part of their insurance plan for all their employees, because they know their bottom line goes up when they make sure their employees get treatment. It is amazing. They've won national awards. We recognize them all the time. We need to make sure that all businesses understand that, because as businesses are demanding of insurance companies, hey, this has to be part of our package for our employees, that will also make a difference. And that has, again, has nothing to do with the Affordable Care Act. It's about us educating and everybody getting involved. Because the other thing that insurance companies are learning is overall health care costs for individuals go down. If it's a person with mental illness and addiction and they get mental health and substance abuse treatment, their overall cost goes down even after adding that. But again, it's still an education process. We still have to work on it.
And that leadership at Chesapeake came from the very top, and that's what we need, leadership at the top. We've gone in and wanted to do screening in corporations for mental health depression screening, and the HR people all huddle together and say, oh, my gosh, what if we do that? And they start to access their benefits. Oh, my gosh, our rates are going to rise. We can't allow that to happen. Really? That shows you how much education, how far we have to go.
I have one quick question on jumping to another drug. Walter White notwithstanding, is meth still a big problem out there, especially in rural Oklahoma?
Yes. Okay. So when you look at our treatment data, our system, okay, we're the public mental health system and substance abuse system. So by the time you get to us, usually people are really struggling, right? They've potentially lost their job. They don't have private insurance. Our data shows the number one issue affecting Oklahomans, and we always forget this, by far in terms of addiction is alcohol. It's about 37% of people who come into our system, and we always forget that. We miss it, and I say we always forget that. We don't always, but it's still the single biggest issue. The next two that are tied are actually meth and marijuana. It's around between 16 and 19% identify meth and marijuana as their number one drug of choice. Now, marijuana, one of the reasons we think it's in our system is because we have such a high arrest rate around it and court-ordered treatment for it. So I don't know if that would change a little bit if that process was a little different. But meth is still a huge issue. So it's still a huge issue. But we forget alcohol. The fastest growing, it's now 14%. The other figures haven't changed a lot. But when I started my job, I've been doing this for about 7 years, about 9% of the population that we serve said prescription drug abuse. It's now 14%. It's not the highest number, but it's the fastest growing. So it's alcohol, it's marijuana, it's meth, it's prescription drugs. But here's the deal. In the end, what happens for people who are addicted, if they can't find the substance they're addicted to, most people will use other substances. So the reason I bring up alcohol, though, is because underage drinking, we think, is a huge gateway to everything else. And we have a whole we have a cavalier attitude. Kids are just going to drink. It's just part of growing up, right? So wrong. How many parents do you think would say, kids are just going to use heroin, it's part of growing up, right? Nobody, I say nobody, we actually have some people who do that, but for the most part, nobody does that. But we don't. We have this different relationship with alcohol, and I think part of it is because as adults and because it's legal, some of us are alcohol users, right? And so we feel like, well, how do you tell your kid not to do it when I do it? Well, here's the deal. If people got how dangerous this was and that kids who drink before the age of 21, kids who drink at 15, are 5 times more likely to be dependent as adults than kids who wait till their 21st birthday, and it has to do with the developing brain, a whole other topic I could spend time on, but alcohol is a huge issue. Underage drinking is a huge issue. We cannot forget to focus on that.
And we don't want to forget tobacco use at young age is a gateway, too. Yep. That's also a piece of that puzzle.
Yes. One last question.
You've talked a lot about funding needs, mm-hmm. and I see that as a healthcare attorney in looking at why don't we have more beds, why don't we have more providers, is because the reimbursement rate is too low. Mm-hmm. So what would happen in our state if we expanded Medicaid, and how would that affect funding for substance abuse and mental health treatment?
Go for it.
Who wants to take it?
Well, you know, I think the marketplace, I mean, if why do opportunities for employment come about is that there's a market for the services, what have you. So I think when we say, oh man, what if we expand Medicaid and we have this Affordable Care Act and, oh my gosh, we don't have enough providers. Well, in time, that'll catch up and that'll begin to change the marketplace, and we need that. And so I think that becomes an excuse not to move forward, and I just reject that. I think we need to continue to move forward, and I think that we're going to be able to see those reimbursement rates come up. I think the people who provide the services are going to be able to be paid, and I think that in time will affect the marketplace in a way where the services are out there and they are available to our community. Does that get at, Teresa? Am I missing that piece of you are going? We have that number. Where's my person who helped me get ready for tonight?
Leave us your email and we'll get that.
What do we call that here? The coverage crater. In that, if we can fill that gap with and access those federal dollars and fill that in, we're going to be able to cover a lot more lives. And that's just the reality of it. And I'm very opinionated about it. You know, I'm kind of like Jimmy Kimmel. He went down the street and said, how many of you are favor Obamacare and how many of you are favor Affordable Care Act? And they said, Affordable Care Act, of course. So I favor the Affordable Care Act.
Please thank our panelists for fielding these questions.
And thank you guys, that you guys care enough to come out here.
Absolutely.
Yeah. That means so much. That shows you that we have a cadre of people in this state who care very passionately about this subject, and we need every last one of you to do this. And I just applaud you all for being here tonight.
We could do at least three more forums on this topic. So thanks for coming. And
thank you.
As you make your way out, feel free to talk with our guests a little and make your way to the table to sign up for an email registration and pick up some of the literature out there. Thanks.